You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
You are now listening to the Ride or Cross podcast.
Great little machine.
Okay, look at us recording.
Here we are, two people recording.
Here we are.
Actually, I'll just do this. I'm sitting up straight to talk to you.
I know. You can also... Yeah, that's good. Yeah, we should just like adjust everything so that...
Uh-huh. There we go. This is nice. This is a great table. Where'd you pick this up?
Thanks. I think TJ found it on some sort of like a Craigslist sort of thing. Did you ever go to our old office?
Which one?
Yeah, right. You did. I think you've been to all of them, but Hoover.
Yeah. Yes.
And it was like a store. So the size of our office slash store then was this table.
I remember it.
So it's the same table.
I remember being very tight.
Yeah.
But you guys made it work, which is the coolest part about the story of it all. Now look at the view you have.
I know. I love the view.
I'm so jealous. I have no view in my office.
Really?
I have no windows.
Really?
No.
Oh,
not in years.
It's once you have windows in your office, there's no going back.
It's debilitating without them.
Yeah, and your body physically needs light to,
yeah,
like a plant, you know?
It's the number one, I think always, and this is total old wives' tale stuff, I think the rings under my eyes are directly related to the amount of time I spend in fluorescent light.
Yeah, I think fluorescent light really screws up your whole body and
whole
everything.
Flow.
Yeah. Because when I worked at CAA, I was in, you know, that's like the most fluorescent light ever.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy who sat next to me for a while also had a lamp and he would turn it on every morning. And I was like, why are you doing this?
Like, I read an article.
We have the brightest lights in the world and you're also turning on a lamp.
He likes to see what he's doing.
Yeah, I just never understood it, and I was also too afraid to ask, to be honest.
Why do you need so much? Why do you need a 60-watt bulb to go with your 2,000 watters up in the ceiling?
Because it almost made me wonder if it's like a tick or something, or like, you know, like an OCD thing or something, like a routine thing. I don't know, something that's like deeper than, oh, I just need more light, because there's no way that anyone would need more light than the light that there was.
Maybe it was the different color hue that he liked, like the soft glow of his little lamp versus the intense penetrating fluorescence.
Yeah.
Oh, I've done it now. Look what I've done. I've broken the whole thing.
It's
okay. Get over here.
Okay. Let's get into it.
All right.
So our guest today is Eric Tobin.
Hello.
I was trying to like think of an intro for you. And so I went back and thought about just how many cool experiences we've had together. And, you know, just going back to when we started Emo Night, you were one of the first people to kind of reach out to us and support what we were doing. And I remember really early on, you invited us over to your house for dinner and you made... I don't know if that was the first one or the second dinner, but you made like a Hungarian dish.
I did. I was very excited to do it. You brought me the best paprika.
Yes.
Which I used so sparingly. I think I had it for a year and I was so sad when it was gone.
I need to bring some next time too. But yeah. And then I met Phil, who is now my brother-in-law, at your house, also at a barbecue. And you've spent Christmas with my family a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And you officiated my sister's wedding.
That's also true. I didn't realize how much a part of your life that I actually am until this moment. Wow.
And it made me realize, you know, we don't see each other often. We're both just have crazy lives. And I think it's hard to see people in general just with the lifestyle that we've chosen to call our life.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
But we've had so many like super meaningful experiences that I feel like you're one of the most important people in my life, honestly.
That is very sweet.
And so I'm really excited to chat today.
Right.
And yeah, so you've been at Hopeless Records for 15 years.
I'm a month shy of 15 years. Okay. Which
What are you gonna do? Are you gonna go clubbing?
Yes, I'll be as a clubbing type of guy. I'll be clubbing all night long. I'll be raving away. I don't know. I probably nothing much.
No.
You know.
I mean, should do something.
Probably should.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Probably go to dinner. I really love food. Yeah, so I'll probably do that.
Good enough. But you should do something to celebrate. Like, that's a really cool, great accomplishment.
I think so. It's especially in LA, as you know, like just holding onto a job for that long. I think people are like, well, maybe he's just bad at writing resumes, or he's just doesn't dream big enough. I like the job, you know, and I think that, you know, having a job somewhere for a long time always felt natural, you know, and I've never thought twice about it. 15 years did creep up. That was like, oh, whoa. I spoke to a prospective employee the other day who said, oh, I've loved All Time Low my whole life. And I got into it maybe when I was 12 or something like this. And I was like, oh, wow, that's, then I started looking at the numbers of when they got into it. I was like, oh my God, I'm old. I've been doing this forever. I've lived through like four generations of emo pop punk kids.
Right.
Which is wild.
But that's really cool. I always admire anybody who has lived in a place for a long time or worked at the same place for a long time, because I'm the complete opposite. You know, like what I'm doing now is by far the longest consistent thing I've had in my life. You know, like I've pretty much moved every year of my life and had a million different jobs and school situations and everything. So I always aspire to have that, just to be settled in and kind of understand what I'm doing. And
this is what I'm talking about. I might have just forgotten that I liked moving around. It got so good. I have no idea. I mean, before this I'd lived in six cities,
right?
And then I just got the job accidentally and stayed there forever.
Well, that's great. Yeah. So walk me through pretty quickly. I don't want to make this the point of this podcast, but just for people who aren't familiar with who you are, you know, how you got into the music industry and what you're doing now at Hopeless and like all the different things, because I know you've done a bunch of different things there as well. So just kind of a run through of what you've done there.
Okay. So at Hopeless now, I'm the EVP of A&R and Business Development. Most of my job is A&R, so I'm mostly searching out and finding talent and then vetting it and then having discussions with my team. You know, I work with a group at the company to say, can we do a good job? Is this the right artist for us to do that job? And then we would sign it. And then once it's there, I spend an inordinate amount of time helping them find an agent, find a manager, get events. I mean, sometimes I'll call you and chase things. I'm largely working in artist development and helping, at least from our standpoint, from Hopeless, is developing that message, that story, and then making that come alive in every facet of what the artist is doing. That's my main job now.
How is that different now? I would imagine it's completely different now than 15 years ago, finding an artist and just kind of embarking on something new. I would assume it's a lot more on the internet versus in real life.
I think, it definitely is. I think So Hopeless is interesting because we didn't technically have an A&R position there when I started there. And I think that we relied on relationships and demos to come in and those type of conversations. Like, you should come down and see this band play. And that's, you know, Lewis, our company president, how he had largely been finding artists. I think even for me, when I first started, it was making as many relationships as possible and then asking them, what are you working on? And then just listening through and asking other people or promoters or whoever, is this artist doing well? How has that changed now? I mean, there are more numbers to look at. And so people, you know, become slaves to those numbers for very good reason. We all have to bring in things that are going to work so we can all get paid and things of that nature. But for these days, it's like you can go and see, oh, wow, these numbers are growing. This artist is connecting. That doesn't take away the other piece, which is, hey, I have a relationship. They told me about an artist they're excited about. I checked it out. I heard what they're hearing or are feeling what they're feeling. And then if I can look at the numbers and show, well, based on this growth, this would be a good reason to sign it. There's a lot of parts that haven't changed at all. There's still got to be a gut to it. There's still got to be heart to it. There still has to be, you know, an entertainer that is incredibly talented and has a story and they're out there selling it. I mean, that's the nice part about being at Hopeless for me. The number one reason I've been there for 15 years, there's many good reasons, but I'm not chasing a number one hit. I'm just not. You know, and it's great when we get it. Doesn't mean that we're not trying, or if we had something great, we wouldn't go for it. If there is an artist that is meaningful and has something to say and kids are showing up to hear that thing and it's changing their life, that's what we really want. And we can sort of build a world around that. And that, that takes time and nurture. So a lot of what we do is hasn't changed. Sorry about that. Hasn't changed whatsoever. But yeah, obviously with looking at Spotify numbers and connectivity on Instagram and other socials or TikTok, or those are going to complement that conversation. They're also going to be a part of the conversation. Like, is this message we believe so much in actually resonating with somebody? And is there a number to show that? That obviously colors the conversation.
And that didn't used to be part of the conversation, right? I would suppose in different ways.
In different ways, right? Yeah. At one time, there was MySpace, and you could go and look at those numbers, and MySpace was super important. That was a huge era. Well, it was important because you could see, you could look at an indicator. That's all that is. Like, Instagram is an indicator. TikTok is an indicator.
I guess I never thought of that. Okay.
I mean, like, if you were
But that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, and you could see the direct relationships, and you could talk about that, right? Before that, look, in the days when I was touring with bands, we had Yahoo groups, we had Instant Messenger on our website, and then we could, if you could go on Instant Messenger and have hundreds of people hitting you up, and you could go and tell somebody, here's what our daily conversations are like, you know, here's how many downloads we've had at mp3.com, including here's a receipt of how many CDs we pressed and we've sold them all. There's always going to be indicators of connectivity. Mm-hmm. That's just so important because, look, sometimes a message is beautiful and wonderful, but if no one can hear it or wants to hear it, that's not great for us. You know, it's hard for us in that case because, look, we're 30 people in 7 countries, and when we plug something in, that's what we mean when we say we have to do a good job for the artist. We have to be able to do that good job. And if we put something in that can't connect, we can't work harder than that artist on that. Like, we could bring it to everybody. And I'm sure out of those relationships we've built, they'd say, no problem. But then the next, when it didn't connect with anybody, we'd go back again and they'd say, hey, you got your freebie. Why don't you go see if this can work? And that's sort of the reality of art, commerce, entertainment. You know, it's got to connect. And so these indicators have been different over time. You know, at least when I started, it was that this is how big our Yahoo group is. This is how big our web, you know, here's our website numbers, you know, our visitors that we're getting, unique visitors. And here's what our email list is right now. And some of those basic things we still do now, we were doing in the ancient era of 2000 and 2001, you know, and then you get a Friendster who became a MySpace, and, you know, yeah, there was a LiveJournal. There was so many different sources of selling at pure volume for a long period of time. You could say my pure volume numbers are my MySpace followers are, or friends are, and you could go sell that. And we would have a critical conversation about, do these numbers reflect growth? And then we would go and sell that back to things like Best Buy and Target. And that landscape has changed now, where it's, are they already connecting on their own on Spotify? Well, that's great, because if they're connecting on the social platform, that's also the sales platform. So, you know, so I had this question at USC the other day, in that it has changed in the sense that those indicators have changed. But the idea is that, does this work for the kid we typically talk to? Do we think we can do a good job for it? Does it have the heart we're looking for? Does it have the message? And then we'll go have that conversation. Mm-hmm. Is there a science to that? There probably could be more of one. I'm sure my boss would love me to have more of one. And I'm trying hard, Lewis. I really am.
Did you teach a class at USC, or were you on a panel or something?
I spoke at Mike Kaminsky's class.
Yeah, we did that too last year.
It's really great.
It was so fun. It made me want to be a professor at some point.
That's funny. It made me feel the same.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, this is cool. I don't know.
Well, people are, I think, want information. You know, I'm sure you get this a lot too for the people that reach out to you. How do I achieve my success?
Right.
You know, in whatever form that comes in, you get that question.
As if there was a secret to it, you know, it's interesting to me because I think a lot of kids in that class were looking to us for guidance in certain areas, that the answer really is just, you got to work hard.
That's it.
Like, there's no shortcut. There is no list of 10 things you can do to be successful. I mean, I guess those 10 things would be work hard.
Well, if you are successful, you could sell those, and many people do. I've seen the self-help book racks wherever I go, you know, and that's why I want to live to 130. I'd like to tell everyone I ate a pine cone every day in hopes that, you know, cosmically people will eat pine cones.
Yeah. I guess there is a lot to it. It's not just work hard. There's a lot more to it, but that's the one key element that you can't take out of it.
Correct. It's time and patience. I mean, I think a kid asked, he said, what's the most, somebody asked, what position should I be seeking at a label? And I said, I have no idea. I think what you should be seeking is to be an entrepreneur. And then you should just go and define what that means for you. Mm-hmm. Because typically an entrepreneur is just a salesperson with a really fancy moniker over the top.
Right. And there are so many different paths to the same outcome.
Yeah.
Which kind of goes back to like all the, what are all the different things besides A&R that you've done at Hopeless?
I was the in-house booking agent for a while. I was the sponsorship salesperson. I was the merch person there. I was the digital promo person. I was the international business development person, international marketing person there. I've done product management. I did sales was a main component of my job for a long time. That really was taking meetings at Target, Walmart, Best Buy. I was working with Apple and Spotify in the early days, and I did all of our YouTube setups and the initial, like when YouTube first rolled out, getting to know the content management systems, our distribution relationships around the world. I mean, I've done a little bit of everything, or at least meddled in everything in the office.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is there anything you haven't done there?
I have never been in charge of accounting, and that's good for everybody.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah. I think I've worked on the systems with our CFO a lot in the past, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, I've looked at models of how we're tracking our income in order to, you know, place our marketing spends against it. And I've been so lucky to be around people like Ian, who's our GM now, and Aaron, who's our head of marketing, and Al. I mean, these are people that have all been there for years with me that we got to sort of test drive a lot of things we thought were good ideas in a small environment, and then see the return of that work, or see the sort of, oh, that didn't work. And we could look at each other and go, well, we just got to get at this again without feeling like you're fired, which I think a lot of people live in that reality.
Right.
And so it's, you know, we're asking again about the 15 years. There was a lot of nurture in that space, but yeah, I've done a lot of jobs there. I started booking bands that didn't have agents, and you know, I was All Time Low's first agent, and I'm sure they would all say that was a terrible experience, and it might have been. And partly the job was to
Was it just difficult booking stuff, or I just didn't enjoy it, or
I didn't mind. Like, that's another weird part about me. It's like I enjoy everything I do. I like working. I just like being busy, and so the working anything is just a puzzle to be figured out. So I didn't hate it. I actually really liked it. There was so many phone calls to make. I could be on the phone for 9 hours a day at that job, and I loved it. It's just hard when bands are that small, and the reason they don't have an agent at the time, like Agency Group or CAA or WME, was that there wasn't that value, wasn't there yet. And it was partly, well, we know that getting bands on tour is one of the key ways things grow in our community. So for me, it was calling small promoters. At the time, you know, you probably know Ryan Soroka, who is one of the a fantastic gentleman. I sold him an All-Time Low show when he was 14 for $75.
What?
Yeah, that was his first show. He did. I think right. His mom, I have to ask him, I think his mom gave him the $75 or something like that. But
yeah. And I guess, again, it's going back to the fact that you had to call people then, mm-hmm. you know, because I think back to when we first started touring Emo Night, some of them we would just DM mm-hmm. venues and be like, yo, can we bring this thing to your venue in Seattle, you know, or we'd easily find their email. It was a lot simpler, I think, than
the time of
calling, or maybe not.
Well, it was different. Like, I need to know who the young promoters in town. I'd have to call the club and say, can you give me the list of promoters? I'd have to look, where did the bands in our community play?
Right.
Or I'd have to go to another agent. I mean, I tell the story all the time when I had a list of managers, tour managers and clubs from the touring days. But I made a list of every band that I could ever think of, and then went on Polestar and looked at the name of all the managers and all their agents and all their labels, and made this long Excel grid with all the names and emails that I collected over a week. And then I emailed over 250 of them during that week, and I got 3 responses. And I asked them for meetings, and I took them out to lunch, and then I asked, do you know so-and-so from priority level down? And they said, oh, I'll introduce you. And then I got an introduction. And then same thing would go. If I saw an artist played some club I needed, I would call the club and say, who are your promoters here? And sometimes they wouldn't take the call. Sometimes they would. I would email, or I would call, and I would get referrals, and I would call that referral, and I would have a talk, and I would always just call and say, you know, look, I have no idea what I'm doing, but it's kind of fun. And we'd start from a human perspective. And then usually I'd say, look, I've got something. Let me think if it's the right thing. And I'd hang up the phone and try not to be a pitch machine. I try to be a friend machine. Mm-hmm. And I like that better. That's what sort of fueled it for me. I was like, oh, look at all these people I know. And what a currency that is for me to feel.
Right. Yeah, I think people forget that, especially through email these days, I think people forget that you're just talking to a person. Mm-hmm. People sound robotic, or they feel like they have the right to kind of be an asshole because it's masked by
Yeah, you can be the tough guy you read about in your whatever your Passman book or whatever thing you're doing.
Which is the least cool thing in the world. Like, I'm not sure at what point in the history of the music industry people decided to let, like, to be an asshole was a cool thing, or it just got more done.
It's great in the movies.
Yeah.
It works great in
Entourage,
movies.
Like, it's cool to be, you know, so intense in entertainment, but in real life, it's just, like, so unnecessary. And so dark, I think. It's really the only part of it all that makes me want to, you know, move to a farm in France and never look back.
I'll be waiting for my invitation.
Yes. But it's just those instances where people are just an asshole for absolutely no reason. It's like, we're booking a show. No one's dying here. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're all good. Everyone's good. It's about, like, the font size on a flyer or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it becomes this whole thing where agents are yelling at managers and artists are huffing and puffing. And it's just, it seems so, like, that part of it all seems really crazy to me. And it's always the one thing that really gets me down and makes me question what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah, I'll agree with you. I think it's that short-term reaction that has nothing to do with life's a little bit longer than this moment where we're talking about 85% versus 75% billing and what that means to your ego and or your career development. And it's like, and I get it. Neither you or I are demeaning other people's needs for that. I just think that the conversation has to be one of sort of kindness, right? Like, look, you know, artists don't fully always understand what this means. They just think they have to fight for it. This could be a scenario. When a manager approaches me with that, right, they take it away from, you need to think about it. I am dealing with an artist who, this is important to them. I want to make this easy for you. I need to please them. What do we do, right? That's all that needs to happen. But in people's, like, need to be on email in their short term, like, they go, look, you're just treating me like crap. Why are you making my problem that my artist hates me? And I think both you and I know that life's a little bit longer than that, and it can be a little more fulfilling where you show up somewhere and you see somebody and it's just so easy, you know?
Right, and it can all be fun. Like, it should all be fun.
Well, right, and that's...
And it's somehow, there's this element to it all where if it does seem too fun, then you're not doing a good enough job, like, you're not working hard enough. You know, like, there needs to be this flavor of, like, intensity to it for it to feel like real work. Is kind of what I've noticed and what I'm trying to work against, because I don't think that every day can't be fun. I think every day totally can be fun. I know there are a lot of things that nobody wants to do and that are boring, but I think it should just all be enjoyable.
I agree. I mean, I think that...
And this is coming from a place where for the first 3 years of Emo Night, I was just losing my mind and operating in a way that wasn't, you know, sustainable. But I now know better, and I now I'm looking back on that and kind of regretting the way that I lived through that.
Look, I'm not going to pretend that there aren't days where I'm like, I can't believe I'm still doing something or dealing with something like this. And I think that we all get to have that woe is me moment. And I think that it's easy to suck in the energy around you, especially as other people. People are unpredictable. One day they're great, the next day they're not. And that's whether that's work or humanity or family or whatever else. And it can be fun. It can be fun if you're looking and saying, look, we are changing the world. And yes, I know we can always say that joke, like, I'm not curing cancer. And it's true, I'm not coming up. I don't work at Gilead or something like that. We're not coming up with life-saving, you know, vaccines for the novel coronavirus this week.
I know.
All the pieces come right at you. But I do think that, you know, what helps me with that all the time is to think that there was a time when I was a kid and, you know, music was incredibly important to the conversation I could have with other kids, you know, and I think that I'm disabled, which, you know, a lot of my young life was spent in medical situations, in the hospital, things like that. And it wasn't easy to make friends. And I got very lucky when I met some kids that were super into like 90s punk rock and hardcore and things like this. And I had no idea what this was. And, you know, and they shared so much music, you know, at the time, like, hey, here's a tape kit and check this out. And they introduced me to other people, and that conversation, like, and I look, I couldn't really afford to buy music. So I was so lucky to have friends who would give me a tape, or I could afford to buy some TDKs and like say, hey, will you make me a mixtape? And, or, you know, I would pick up old volumes of Maximum Rock and Roll from friends and memorize reviews. So I could be like, yeah, I know that band, which is scammy. I know, but I just really wanted those friends. It was so important to me not to be alone. And going to the shows was this amazing feeling of like, wow, look at the people around me. That these people are in the same stuff I'm into. And if they wear the t-shirt, then I can talk to them about the thing I'm into. And it was about teams and groups, right? Like, I couldn't be into sports, couldn't play sports, and likely wasn't going to hang out with kids that did. They lived a different lane of existence than I did. And you know, someday I'll dream of being a better bro or more masculine maybe, but the music part of it was great. And like those first shows, that first Descended show I went to, the first Violent Femme show I went to, where it was, there were weird kids there that were into weird things, and they all wore the t-shirts and all spoke the language. And all of a sudden I had my tribe or my group or whatever you want to call it. That was meaningful. Without that, I could have been in a pretty bad place. And there was a conversation, there was a politic that I got to be a part of, and I learned a group language. And so for what we do every day, at the core of it, there is a kid who comes early and hits the barricade and doesn't care how many times they get kicked in the head because they were there. And the conversation that I leave is, I was at the front row. I was there before you were. I bought the t-shirt. Did you see that part? You missed it? I can't believe it. Holy crap, I bought this record. That culture currency makes the world wealthy. And it's easy to forget because we all have bills to pay and things to do. And I get that this is commerce and it is a job. That's why when we vet artists and we think about structure and buildings and insurance and two-ply toilet paper and everything else that goes into running a business, but the products we work on have meaning to someone somewhere. And there's not a way to quantify what that meant to it. For me as a kid, without that language, without that group, I don't get to enjoy the life I've enjoyed. To hear the stories of like so-and-so hitchhiked to the hate before Instagram. I was like, what is that like? And they're like, oh, I met this homeless guy and we got drunk and I don't even remember. And to me as a kid, that tall tale was the biggest thing I'd ever heard. And I'd read every National Geographic to that point. And all I wanted to do was figure out what hitchhiking was and how to do it. But I didn't have that opportunity until I met a kid that liked music who gave me a mixtape, and I showed up at a house with this amazing woman who bought us all booze and then put on a party, and I met this weird kid who hitchhiked back and forth to San Francisco. My mind was rocked, and music brought that. Crappy punk rock bands from New England that weren't good and didn't even know if they could ever be famous brought that to my existence. And so when I think of people arguing over their 85% billing, I quickly always remind myself that, like, you know what? This has value. And as long as I can help this manager or whoever understand that I know you're up against a situation that can't be explained, let me help you so you can help the world. And that helps me.
That's a really good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Okay. I feel like that'll help me next time. Because for me, I feel like it takes me all the way to actually being at the show we're working on, mm-hmm, to then understand the importance of it. Like in that moment where I'm experiencing that conflict, it's hard to take myself to I guess reflect on those memories of how music has changed my life and start to think about how it's changing other people's lives now, mm-hmm, and how, you know, so many people have told us that emo night, like, you know, they were going to kill themselves one night and instead they came to emo night and it changed the course of their future and all these kinds of things. I those are always really important, but I feel like I have to hear those things in person.
Right.
For it to really, like, even if I read it online, it doesn't have the same gravity as if somebody comes up to me during the show and tells me their story. But I guess that's a really good way to to look at it and to kind of approach it next time is, mm-hmm, actually remember those times and kind of reflect on that and realize there's always a bigger picture, but sometimes it's easy to get stuck on that one thing.
Yeah, it is. And people are, you know, there are, as you know, many people who enjoy emotional warfare.
Sure.
And it brings them great joy. Yeah,
it's 99.999% of the time it has to do with your personal life. Mm-hmm. You know, someone is talking to you in a certain way. It has nothing to do with the situation. It's just about their level of happiness in their life as a whole.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone who's fully stoked on themselves and stoked on their life would ever even have it in them to act that way.
We hope. We really hope. It's just, some days it's challenging, but yeah, I think, and it's, yeah, you're right. I think I hope that most times, like, and I think you say when you do a lot of interpersonal relationship reading or, you know, courses or anything, they'll always say, like, you have to understand, you don't know what the other person's going through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've learned recently that when it comes to conflict, it's so easy to say you did versus saying the way I'm hearing.
Yes.
Yeah. Which has to be practiced. Look, I'm 40 and I don't consider myself perfect in this place. And I'm still learning that it's so easy to hear someone say, well, you did this. And we just say, well, to go defensive and understand that sometimes feelings need to be heard. And sometimes you just have to respond with, I'm hearing it a certain way and I'm processing it a certain way and I may need time or I may need something else. And when it comes to business, we don't have that luxury sometimes. And I think practicing that on and personal sides or when you can helps you in that moment where you're like, oh, wow, this is heating up for really no reason.
And yeah.
If it has to be set aside, like, look, I can't make this decision right now. I want to, but I can't.
So I always ask everybody who comes on here this question, and it kind of, you know, we've kind of like touched on it a little bit, but you know, it just like life just gets crazy in general. It's not even working in music. It's just life in general. And so what are some things that you do to kind of like maintain your mental stability? I know you travel a lot, which is really cool. I was sort of stalking your Instagram yesterday.
Thank you.
And I love it so much. I never realized how much I love your Instagram because it's I ask about this too of, you know, how we're obsessed with social media and we're obsessed with presenting ourselves in a certain way to the world and the toll that that has on our mental wellness and our lives as a whole. But I feel like your Instagram is exactly it's being used the way that Instagram intended for the app to be used. Mm-hmm. It's just like these really nice pictures. It kind of shows all the cool travels that you've been on. And it's just a beautiful, beautifully curated page versus like 100 selfies every day.
I would not want to put anyone through 100 selfies of me. Well, thank you for that. And thanks for stalking. It's nice to be stalked.
Yeah.
It's good.
I found, I scrolled like way back, but the photos from Hungary were so... It just took me back. It was so nice.
It was a very fun trip. It was, it'd be it's a much longer conversation to talk about that particular trip. I spent 3 weeks. I went to Manchester to sign a band. At that time it was Stand Atlantic, who are now with Hopeless.
Oh, I love Stand Atlantic.
I also did too. And I was so freaked out that I wasn't going to get them. And I was going to go on vacation. And then I got pushed up 5 days because they were finishing their tour in the UK, and it's like, I have to fly there. And I think I made them go to Nando's for like 4 hours and listen to me just ramble on. And I took them to drinks and I wanted to get that done so bad. And you know, and it's funny because after it was done, I was like, well, I don't really know if I get this or not. And I started that trip early and I really more than anything wanted, some time by myself just to sort of connect. And I went and did a bunch of cities. I think when I saw you had already done, I think 4 cities in Europe.
You had been traveling.
Yeah. And I was like, I photographed my friend Walter's child's preschool Christmas pageant, met the mayor of Milan and we hung out for a bit. And then I think on the way down to Hungary, I met these really odd models because I had won $3,000 in a Prague casino because I spent all night talking to Chinese gangsters. And it was for me... You know, I'll tell you, because we had met the other day and we talked about it. And the travel part of it has been so important to me because being alone and experiencing the world and allowing whatever to happen is such a part of what I wanted when I was getting away from home. You know, and I mentioned the disabled thing before. I think that so many people are encouraging, while at the same time that encouragement, you can hear it and say, look, it's going to be hard for you. And, you know, you should just consider that and find a lane that's going to take care of you. And that can be thought of, oh, I guess I'm not going to do anything great, or I can't do anything great. And I heard these stories, and I
can you explain a little bit what your disability is and sort of like what you're referring to when you're saying people told you you couldn't do a certain thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born with spina bifida, and it is there are three levels of it. I have the myelomeningocele level, and it is a neural tube defect. It is a congenital disorder. It is thought to be genetic. It's thought to be environmental as well. They don't really know. They have pretty good studies, but not great studies. It's challenging in that way. When you're born, part of your spine is open and your spinal cord is on the outside of your body when you're born. And this causes a plethora of issues. I had my first surgery when I was 3 months old to close that opening. And so it specifically, because it's basically a spinal injury when you're born, is the best way to describe it to someone I met on a train or a bus or something like that.
Yeah.
And, for most people, it affects everything from muscle development in your legs, bone development, nerve development. It affects bowel, bladder, kidneys, small intestine, heart, can affect the brain. Many people with spina bifida have hydrocephalus. Most people have a shunt. I'm very lucky. I don't have one. Very, very lucky not to have one. You know, can cause other pressures on the spine, tethering of the spinal cord. It's the list goes on and on. There are things that are connected to it that we don't know why, because there's such a lack of research. And there's almost, as over 170,000 people in the U.S. that have this disability, which is four times more than cystic fibrosis, which gets a lot of press. For me, specifically, I can't feel my legs. I have a, I guess you call it like a partial paralysis. No, I cannot feel anything from my legs or my feet. It's caused issues in bone muscle development in my legs, which causes a lot of issues. As you see today, I'm here on crutches because I have injuries on both my feet right now. And it causes, you know, everything from sores from sitting too long on your legs. I mean, when I first started at Hopeless, I was doing these like crazy 15-hour days, and I sat still for so long I can't feel my butt. So I would get up and be like, oh my god, I have a callus on my butt. It was very hilarious. Maybe not for the doctor, but for me, I was like, this is awesome. I am definitely putting in the time. But it causes that, you know, and there's it's a lot to deal with, you know. And I've had, you know, over 25 surgeries in my life. I've been on crutches too many times to count. You know, a lot of the surgeries are when you're you know, going through puberty, a lot of the developments in your body are triggering other issues with the spina bifida, which is causing growth problems. And so I spent a lot of middle school and the end of elementary school in the hospital. I had a major surgery on my back. I was out for 3 months. You know, it was a 13-hour surgery I had, where I had to sort of learn how to walk again and all of that. And so I spent a lot of time in that developmental period in a hospital, meeting nurses and doctors and learning about scheduled time for food. And in, you know, the 80s and the 90s, it was 13 channels on the TV and mostly soap operas during the day and the beeping machine. And you get to learn a lot about patients. But that is what I have. I have spina bifida. It is a lifelong thing. I think that if you look it up, if anyone was to listen and look it up, they'd see mainly people consider it a pediatric disease. As you notice, I'm not a child. I'm 40 years old. So that's the issue with it. So, you know, on the sort of social psycho connectivities to that disability, is that you are kind of to feel that you can't do things that other people can do, right? I obviously can't do sports. I wasn't a choice in that way, though I probably would have chosen not to. I couldn't do it, you know, and there were limitations to what I felt I could do. You know, I can't go out and drink as heavy as other kids, or I can't do this because what will happen to me? And there's always that fear in your mind. And I really built a lot of that up. And in the meanwhile, I was feeling like, you know, I read a lot as a kid, adventure stories and travel magazines. And I just got this in my mind, like, I have to go and do what I want to do. And, but I didn't really know the pathway to that. And I got very lucky along the way, meeting some of the people I met, and just, you know, as soon as I get a car, I was like, well, I'm just going to drive my crappy car out to the coast. And well, you know what, I'm going to skip school and I'm just going to go and do this thing. And I found that solace in meeting new people and meeting strangers and being generally exuberant. And maybe we've been together in places, Babs, where I've just said, been overly crazy to somebody, like kind to somebody there, because I'm going to ask them what's next and where do I go and who do I meet. And that became so fulfilling in my life, to just see things. And I've been here, and I don't think I thought I could do this. And maybe other people too didn't think I could do this, but I definitely didn't think I could. And one-upping myself became an exercise in understanding myself better.
Right. I would think that people telling you you couldn't do something fueled your desire to do it even more.
Typically, right? Yes.
So yeah. It's, yeah, I feel like you want to see like all these places to kind of check it off a list, right? Like,
I have a very long list, yes.
Yeah, which is awesome, I think, in a way, because I think most people kind of wait around for the right time to do things and they let life just kind of pass them by. But I think you are very aware of yourself and your body and your limitations and life. And I think it's really cool just to see you living it to the fullest. And also, you're one of the kindest people I've ever met. And that's really rare, honestly.
Just, well, thank you.
It's super rare and it's sad, but it's rare. And so I think, I don't know, it's just cool to like to see you doing all these things. Like the fact that you just climbed Everest.
That was fun. That's
challenging. Insane. The whole time I was watching you do that through stories, I was like tired from just watching it, like straight up.
I was also tired of being there.
There's really no turning back. I feel like once you start, no. Like I got to do it.
What you can get a helicopter ride, you know. So my partner Alicia went with me, and I think we had wildly different experiences up there. And I don't think that I'm outing her at all. She would tell you, we often will go to a party and be like, "How's Everest?" I'm like, "Alicia, tell them how it was," and she'd be like, "Oh my God, it was crazy hard." And yeah, it was hard, you know. But I think that for me, that was always on the list, and you know, I know that I can't do that forever. I mean, even at, you know, I turned 40 and it was a big thing to do for my 40th. And I, you know, I think my doctors are so funny. The ones I see all the time, they're like, "I tell you not to do this, but I'd just be wasting my breath." And yeah. I was like, "Yeah, so you start to need to show me how to do surgery if I needed to do it on my own." He's like, "I can't show you that, but maybe I can show you that." And, you know,
scary.
But I mean, look, it's just for me, I think people recognize like I want to do that and I need to do that. And I think that I'm not I'm not trying to say I don't even understand my own mortality. So, you know, there's regular human fear and all that, but I want to go and experience that. And it was, look, it was 92 miles. It was 13 days of walking, and right in the middle, you can lie down and say, "I can't go any farther." Your options are a $3,000 in cash helicopter pickup. And that's it. That's the options, actually. It was just A with no B, full stop.
Okay.
And
so you have that option at any moment?
Sure. Yeah, you could. And then you could lay down there and flag down a helicopter, and someone will have to put you in a stretcher and drag you to wherever it can land.
Okay.
And you don't want that option.
Right.
And people did have to fly back. We knew really? They got sick. I mean, you have altitude sickness up there that's to deal
my,
with.
Yeah, that's my thing.
That is very challenging. Not to mention that
I can't even deal with the slightest altitude change. It's really sad.
Well, I'll tell you, at 17,000 feet, it's not pleasant feelings. Your hands go to sleep and, you know, I mean, I don't have to worry about tingles in my legs because I can't feel them. You get these crazy headaches.
Headaches, yeah.
Yeah, and stomach aches and things like that, which stomach aches can mask the standard thing that you deal with up there, which is traveler's diarrhea. I mean, the food is, you cannot drink water. It all has to be boiled or treated with iodine along the whole way. You do not want to put water into your hole in your face and hope for the best.
Right.
Food is cooked. It's wonderful. It's awesome. Your stomach's not used to it. Everyone else's stomach is used to traveler's diarrhea.
What kind of food is it?
Mostly Dalbot. They'll say 24-hour power. Dalbot is it's curried lentils over rice with pickled vegetables, and it has got the perfect amount of water, protein, starch, and sugars in it. And I would eat it twice a day, except for the mornings when I had boiled eggs and ramen noodles from the package. And
yum.
Breakfast ramen noodles, I've got to tell you this from the bottom of my heart. Ramen for breakfast is the best thing I've ever had in my life.
And honestly, sign me up.
It's awesome.
Sign me up.
Water and plenty of salt, because you're just going to, you need it up there.
Right.
And
you need every ounce of energy.
Well, of course. And then, you know, for me, like blisters are common up there, but I can't feel my feet. And so like every day, you know, every hour I have to stop and take a look at my feet because I have to actually visually inspect them and then rebandage them if I need to. And I have to, like a boxer, I have to tape them up inside shoes that I've been wearing for a year. But I spent 13 months training, hiking 4 miles, 5 days a week, you know, just to mostly see what would happen.
Were you hiking to train? Were you hiking in elevation?
Around here, actually. You know, everyone said, like, you can try and do hypoxic training and all this stuff. They said, honestly, get in the best shape you can so you know your body.
Right.
I'm sure that there are people who are summiting that need to go do that. I hiked California as much as I could. I ate right. I got in shape. I lost weight. Mainly for me, it was like, what do my feet look like after 4 miles? What do they look like after 6 miles? What do my legs feel like the second day? Where am I seeing any bruises? And so I could go to the doctor and say, what's happening here? Like my research was, I mean, half my backpack was medical supplies. Mm. And I luckily didn't have any issues. All the issues happened 2 months later, which we got to be thankful for that, you know? But, you know, to your question of, you know, where do I go for my mental health hangouts? You know, for me, I read a lot. I read incessantly. A lot of it is philosophical. A lot of it is fiction. I love stories. I love anything of people telling about their life. I ask people questions all the time. I told this to an artist yesterday. I asked, what's your story? They tell me their story, and it's probably the best part of the job. And then you go and do something like this, and you can apply everything you've learned to that. And if you can find that moment to say, we'll take Nepal for example. These mountains are epic, and they've been here for millions of years, and I won't be. What does that mean to me? And you'd see these dogs, just thousands of stray dogs, and they would sort of sometimes ignore you, and sometimes they'd walk up to you and walk with you for 2 hours without rhyme or reason, and then they just walk away. Yeah. And you'd have to,
cute.
You could just come up with a story in your mind, like what's this hyperbole? Like, what is this dog? What is he
Who
thinking?
Is she?
You know, right? And but that to me is the daydreaming I spent so much time of as a kid running away from what my issues were. You know, like obviously being disabled in school is challenging. Kids aren't great.
Kids aren't great just like in general.
No,
you know?
And I'm not faulting them. I'm never mad. I never go back and say, oh, I'm not making like some crazy list. Like kids were kids. You know, different.
But
I was
so
different. And that's fine. Like,
In middle school, I straight up had, I don't know. Have you ever seen a photo of me in middle school?
No, but I'm excited to check that out.
Yeah, I will send you one. It was a dark time. I had really thick glasses that were bifocal, so they magnified my eyes by like a million. Mm-hmm. And then like, you know, obviously braces. I was abnormally thin. Mm-hmm. I had crazy frizzy hair. So, and then on top of that, I had one eye covered for 10 years because I had a lazy eye. So it's to correct it. So my mom, bless her heart, would put like really cute photos on my glasses. Like she'd cut out little like, you know, pictures of bunnies or something. But, you know, nonetheless, I had a covered eye for 10 years. And it's like even adults would come up to us at the market and be like, what's wrong with her?
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of stays with you.
I sat next to you at lunch in middle school. Thanks for hanging out with me. I appreciate that. It was really nice of you to be there for me when I needed it the most.
Yeah.
Because your problems were similar to mine. And it was good to connect at 12 years old. I totally get it. I can't even imagine. I knew what it was like for me. And even with adults and teachers, like when you call in, like my mother was awesome and she would call in and the teacher said, my kid's got an issue. When he needs to go to the bathroom, you got to let him go to the bathroom. And the teacher would come in and say, okay, class, if Toba needs to get up to go to the bathroom, you got to let him.
Jesus.
And the whole class turns around and looks like, what's up, pee pants?
Right.
You know, and I think that, you know, you spend a lot of time getting out of your own head as a child, right? Like you spend a lot of time daydreaming and you spend a lot of, or at least for me, you know, like stories could take me away and I could come up with my own stories. And it really, it's isolating. And I, you know, my brother and I are super close and, you know, I always had my brother and we could always be friends. And I think that, you know, there's not a decision you can make as a child, which way can I go? You know, mentally, you know, you just sort of go the path. For whatever chemical reason I got lucky, I just lived through it, you know, and I'm sure there are layers of defense mechanisms that I'll spend the rest of my life trying to defeat, but those things got me through. Mm-hmm. And I think that partly for me, that sort of daydreaming and storytelling and, you know, tall tales and everything else got me to a place where to see the world and even, you know, I got here a little early and I sat in the park over here. I sat just outside my car at the park, just staring at some of the people there. And I was just imagining what that's like and what a great day it is and how much I like the architecture here. And, you know, it is not always great to daydream or be distracted all the time. But for me, I find great solace in seeing all the things and enjoying them just for what they are. And that's just who I am. And
I love that.
And it's fine.
I love that.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a lot of, you know, what meditation does. So I feel like you already have that engraved in you just to appreciate the little things, which is cool.
Yeah.
For me, that takes everyday training.
But I do think that the, you know, cause we talked, like, I do think the training of that is look, I could do more of it too, just to sort of help myself get a little more focused sometimes, mm-hmm. because everything's everywhere. And I know that that can be exhausting for people in my life. And I don't fault them for being exhausted with that sometimes. And but I think everyone should take that opportunity to train themselves up, because there is this incredible world out there that is filled with good and bad things. But we have that opportunity to define that personally. And if we don't open up our eyes and look, it'll be gone.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that the world is ending, like your world is passing by, you know. And someone asked me the other day, like, whoa, do you feel like life's just passed you by at 40? I'm like, not really. And yeah. I don't expect that it will going forward, you know, as much time as I have left. And we never know. Like, there's no guarantees.
Nobody knows.
Yeah. There's just no guarantees. And, you know, there's a kid running around jumping in puddles, you know, a couple of years ago, I was in Alaska, and, I was driving by this really oddly desolate area with an old building. And there's this mother down there with her kid, and he's jumping in puddles. And what a great joy. And I have this awesome photograph. It's actually, if you go deep on my Instagram, there's this little kid in a rain suit on there. And, you know, the lesson that I had to be reminded in that situation, it was cold and it was rainy, and this kid was having the time of his life. And there's not an equation for him at that age. There wasn't for us, right?
Right.
I want to jump in water. It doesn't have to be bigger than that. And to him, the more that his mother's like, stop getting all crazy dirty, he was like, oh, this is amazing. And you know, of course, he's dressed in full rubber gear. So it's just, you know, I think to find that place where you can say, I'm just looking. I don't need a deeper meaning. I'm just looking, and it's here, and that's it. And I can look behind the curtain, but it wouldn't matter anyways. That's totally fine to be in that place. And that, for me, can be relaxing, because the 75% billing equation is one of all life, right? From the bank to the buying of a house to the landlord to the girlfriend or the boyfriend who's having a bad day, and to I don't look good enough, and how did I get so gangly, or what's up with my hair today, and I just don't know if I'm going to get the raise that I want. What will people think of me? And the thousands of things that are actually distracting us all day long, and I have all of those too. Because everything we do today doesn't hurt us today. It hurts us in 5 years, right? And we have to constantly think of that. It's okay to go outside and jump in the proverbial puddle, because, you know, it's just water and you can, and maybe just fuck it.
Yeah. I love that. That's a great, I feel like that's a great way to end it. Fuck it, you know?
I'm in.
I also love that I did not look at my notes once.
Sorry about that.
I'm sure I touched on most of it. No, it's great. It's like we just had a conversation, which is the best. Thank you so much for coming by.
It was so wonderful to be invited, and I appreciate any time I can spend with you, Babs.
Same. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Ever heard of Stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of Stoicism with a lowercase s and not Stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference. All that is Stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.